Hello, this is Pastor Zach again at Faith Connection in Wilton Center, Illinois. We are happy to be here, and this is a not so one-off, but one-off for this year, Christmas Bible study that we have affectionately named Zach Ruins Christmas. I know this has been highly anticipated. This is some fun stuff that we're going to do. In my opinion. And again, as we've said in our previous Bible studies, this is more for us. This is more for our people. Where the real Bible study and action is actually together, gathered. But we understand some people can't make it. Some people are out of town. And we don't want to have people, especially our members and our people in our community, who feel like they missed out because they couldn't be there. So this is not for profit. This is not for anything other than we here in Wilton Center at Faith Connection gathering together to dive in a little bit and grow deeper in our faith. So what we're going to seek to do today is maybe dismantle some of the idealized, taken for granted, assumed pictures we have in our head about Christmas, the story of Jesus' birth and the events that lead up to it. And that's not really ruining Christmas. I get it, right? It's kind of tongue-in-cheek what we're saying. But we understand that there are some things that maybe aren't even in the Bible that we've kind of assumed or culture has put together that have maybe influenced the way we picture, perceive, understand the story. Or maybe we've taken the symbols of the story and taken that as face value and never really unpacking and going deeper as we should with these stories. So my goal here is not to give you answers. My goal here is actually to kind of give you the more biblical, scholarly perspective, to give you better context of the first century so we can just read and hear these stories a little better, a little crisper. We're not going to try and tie up all the theology and make it relatable to the world in the sense of, and this is what you take home and away from it. Yes, normally Bible studies do that. But this is just an acknowledgement that, you know, if we're talking about a story that was written in the first century about a first century family in Israel, in Palestine, what we would consider now part of the Palestinian parts of Israel, that's where Bethlehem is right now, then we would understand that that's very different. And just thinking about it, 200 years ago was very different. Think about life in 1800, right? Even in our own culture, our own country of the United States of America, there were no cars, there were no phones, no indoor plumbing, slavery was still a thing, the White House was finished being built, but was not fully moved into until 1801 by Thomas Jefferson. And again, the United States was still just those 13 colonies with newer territories like the Mississippi River. Illinois wasn't even a state. So if we can imagine just that world being so different in the way people talked and interact and their culture and the things that they take for granted versus what our culture, context, language, and the things we take for granted are different. Imagine another 1,800 years between that. So how we're going to start is, first we're going to talk about just traditions that maybe are not quite in the Bible, but that are traditions in Christmas, and kind of break down some of that, the ideas and how we celebrate Christmas. And then we'll move on to the more biblical stuff, where the stories and how we read them and how we see them. So with that, let's dive in. I think for us, we all have different traditions for Christmas, how we tell the story, what we focus on. I can honestly say that on Christmas Day, if we trace back just what Christmas Day is, we recognize that there's a feast or a festival, and that is ancient, and it includes a day of fasting in preparation for that day, for Christmas Day, which we call Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve is supposed to be the day of fasting. You're actually supposed to fast during Christmas, but you didn't equate that today with fasting. I think for most of us, it's filled with food and treats and deliciousness, maybe even some family or friends gathering. Not necessarily prayerful meditation and the Word of God and refraining from certain types of food. However, we do see that in many traditions, Christmas Eve doesn't have meat being served. We talked about in our Bible study that those of us who know Catholics, we know that during Lent, when they fast, they don't eat meat. They refrain from chicken and beef and pork and all that. But usually it's substituted with, you know, fish, seafood. And we find that that's something that we get to experience on Christmas Eve for certain family traditions. In my own, we have a Christmas Eve dinner where it's pasta and fish. We, on another side, there's no pasta, but there's still tons of different kinds of fish. And it's holding back to that idea, even if we're not aware of it, that these cultures, these traditions, are coming from the idea of fasting, that Christmas Eve is a preparation day for Christmas Day. I wonder if your own family has those kind of traditions, or maybe you remember your parents or grandparents who were immigrants from another country. Maybe they have stories like that. Could be fun to ask around or explore. Now, the other thing is Christmas isn't just one day. It's a whole season, and a very short season. We typically label it 12 days. That's why we have that song, 12 days of Christmas my true love gave to me, right? 12 days of Christmas is the season. So Christmas is a season, and it doesn't begin on December 1st, or, you know, if you're a Target and Walmart, it doesn't begin October 15th. It begins on Christmas, December 25th, and goes for 12 days. The liturgical color, because we do follow some of the liturgical traditions here at our church, is white. And it's supposed to cover and celebrate the birth of Jesus. And it actually has a season that is capped off with Christmas Eve. That prepares us for the birth of Christ, for the birth of Jesus. And that's what we celebrate Advent. That's what we're in right now. Advent's color is purple, sometimes blue. Some traditions go blue as well. But the idea is that we are preparing for Jesus's coming. Advent, as I've taught many times, even from the pulpit, that Advent is a time where we remember Jesus's birth, his first coming, the incarnation, in anticipation, longing, and hope for his second coming, when Jesus will return, when the day of the Lord will happen, when heaven and earth are made one, and all the world will be blessed. So that's what Advent is. It should get us excited. I know we have people in our congregation that are big on rapture theory, that, you know, end time stuff. This is your season. This is what it should be. We should all be really excited and focusing on Revelation and Jesus returning, because that's been the history of this season. And that's why we tell stories such as we've had in church now, Zechariah and his song, the Benedictus, and Mary and her Magnificat, her song. All of them have this longing and expectation for the Messiah to come, and yet have this eye towards the future where things are complete and he is already here. We take those themes and we hold on to them during this season. So that's pretty fun. And this isn't uncommon to have a preparatory season before a major feast or festival. Think of Lent and Easter. Lent, you prepare for the resurrection. And at the same time as we remember Jesus' resurrection, we look forward to the day of his return and our resurrection. So again, all these little things that maybe we don't give any time to during the normal church season, during our lives, but what we do is supposed to be shaping ourselves on the life of Christ and reminding us of what's important and what we believe and why we believe it. That leads me into saying that Christmas, then, is not a day that is pagan. Many have confused it with other holidays that are ancient and what would in the church be called pagan. However, scholarship in and outside of Christianity shows that no other holidays or pagan religions were celebrated around this time when Christians began celebrating the birth of Christ. This is true now, and there were later religions that had overlap with our tradition, but if we're being honest, this is uniquely our own. This day, when we celebrate it, and particularly why, that's all original to us. So I know it's in pop culture, very common around this time of year, to talk about how Christmas is this made-up holiday that borrowed everything from every other religion, and there's nothing truly Christian about it. I've heard tons of TikToks and Instagrams and YouTube videos that circulate, I'm sure, every year. But Pastor's here to tell you that's not true. That's more armchair theology than anything else. But what is true is the bad math of Jesus' birthday. Most likely, Jesus wasn't born on December 25th. The ancients would calculate births and deaths and have special significant ways of doing it that were unique to their own time, that made sense to them. And so if Jesus died somewhere in March and they calculated that out to be around March 25th, then Jesus must have been born December 25th, because deaths and births were connected back then. We would call that bad math today, and we giggled in our Bible study about that. But that's how we got the short version of December 25th. This also really jives with when we do think that Jesus was born, which was most likely the spring. So if we're talking about myths being busted, is the birth of Jesus December 25th? No, it's actually probably sometime in the spring, maybe even later, early summer, something like that. And we get that because of Luke's retelling of the shepherds. The shepherds are out. The shepherds are with their flocks. Many say that wouldn't happen in the winter, that would happen later in the spring, summer. So no snow on Jesus' birthday for sure. Sorry if that maybe changes some things. But again, I would rather us be honest and know a little bit more of the context and the culture than, you know, getting up and finding somebody who's ranting and raving and making you question. Again, the whole point is to inform us, not to hide anything, right? And that's where misinformation comes from, when we don't always get the full picture. So why Christmas? Why December 25th? Bad math, but also, who wants to have all of our major holidays back to back? Again, in the church calendar, in the church life, we try and center the whole year on the story of Jesus, his life, death, resurrection, and even his expectation of being born and the longing that the people had for it. So it doesn't make sense to have both his birth and his resurrection all in the same month. We wanted to spread it out. So we use the bad math as good reasoning, and we just kind of kept it, because why not? Another thing that's usually associated with Christmas is our traditions. And let's be honest, Christianity has kind of always taken and borrowed things from cultures around that have had significance and meaning and applied it to Christ, right? We think of Halloween, where some poor people and the kids would go around house to house, maybe dressing up, or you have a tradition that was borrowed where, you know, they would decorate squashes and pumpkins up near Britain and Ireland and all that. That's pagan. That's probably left over. That's not the reason for the season, but it's a way to celebrate. It's something that has seeped in. And there's things like that, but there's good history that at one point Christmas was celebrated by the poor and the children walking around, much like they did for Halloween, asking for gifts, charity, handouts. Again, different time, different place. And if you didn't, you might get vandalized. It could definitely a different way of celebrating Christmas than we do today. But one of the ways we do celebrate Christmas that I find fascinating that is uniquely our own is Christmas trees. Typically, I have heard that Christmas trees in pop culture are not ours. It's a pagan religion. It's a winter solstice thing. And you've got all these other things. But truthfully, where we have gotten our tradition from is kind of in the Germany area of the world, probably around the between 14 to 1600s. And it's not uncommon on big festivals and big feasts, holidays, right? Easter, Christmas, All Hallows Eve, to retell the story of salvation from the beginning in Genesis in the garden all the way to Jesus and why Jesus is important. And this could be done in churches, this could be done in town squares. And if you're living in that part of Europe, in that part of the world, there's probably not too many good trees out there for a tree of life, for a tree of knowing good and bad. But you know what is? Pine trees, conifers, right? And so they would use those trees, and they may even put some fruit on there or things that look like fruit to dangle from them. And eventually people started putting them in their homes because it was a way to remember the story of salvation. Dare I say, even the candles that began putting on there stem from the Advent candles and the light and the darkness. And we begin to see that our own meaning and our own significance of those trees are uniquely our own. That they tell a story, and a story that maybe isn't being told elsewhere, that is deeply rooted in the Bible and its history. We know that, right? We had a whole series on trees and how important trees are. So it makes sense during this time that we are gathering together that we put a symbol of the tree of life that is and culminates in Jesus into our homes, that lights up our life and is a light to the world. So that may not ruin Christmas. That may actually add to your Christmas, where honestly, you may look at your Christmas tree a little differently. Whew. All right. Here's the fun one. Here's one last big fun thing before we get into the Bible. That's good old Saint Nick. In our house, it's definitely a tradition. We definitely speak of good old Saint Nicholas. And what has been particularly fun is realizing that, if we're being honest, Santa Claus in America looks very different than how Santa Claus of history looked. And let's also just be honest that not every culture around the world, even Christian cultures, have a Santa Claus. You know, one of my favorite is you have La Befana, the Christmas witch in Italy, which has a similar function role as what we would traditionally call Santa Claus. But it has its own myth and story. And we should recognize that our idea of Santa Claus is much more informed by Coca-Cola than it is history or the Bible. So with that being out of the way, I kind of want to introduce us to Santa. To good old Saint Nick, because I think for some of us, we don't really think about that aspect of our faith, where Saint Nicholas comes from. So, Saint Nicholas was the Bishop of Myra, which is Turkey, around the 4th century. He was someone who was known for his generosity and his charity. Many of these saints that you hear start off super wealthy, give it all away, and he is no different, right? So, first part of his myth, his story, right? Because there's only so much we could actually know about him in history. But he heard a father in town that he was over as bishop was too poor to pay the dowry of his daughters to be married. And so they were going to fall into prostitution. Because if you didn't have money to help give them away, and money was tight, that means they were going into poverty. It's not uncommon to give away daughters to be prostitutes. Horrible, awful, absolutely. And good old Saint Nick comes in and starts throwing bags of money through the windows of the house, enough that eventually each daughter is married out. And I'm sure at this point, right, we're a week away from Christmas, and we are all praying that St. Nicholas also starts dropping bags of money through our windows. But it gets to the end, and of course the father figures out that it's St. Nicholas, and he's told not to tell, and these daughters are able to live good and happy lives. And so although it's not St. Nicholas throwing them down a chimney, right, it is a story of St. Nicholas giving gifts in that particular way. Number two story about St. Nicholas is a couple of stories of just him feeding towns. That seems to be common, where there's a famine that hits and St. Nicholas is there and helps feed and care for the poor, the hurting, and the hungry. It's a very Jesus story. Again, saints and their stories and their lives are supposed to encourage us to really strive to be like Christ. And we see Christ in these people. And saints aren't gods or special in the sense that they're magical, but that they're supposed to encourage us to be more like Christ. And we see in their life Jesus. And what better way to see Jesus than feeding people who are poor, hungry, and starving? Okay, myth number three. And this one we can't find in any historical records, but it has 100% persisted because it's just that funny and juicy for a lot of people who read it, mainly because it breaks with our sweet idea of sweet old Saint Nick. So the story begins that at the Nicene Council, the Council of Nicaea in 325, that council was being called because of a theological argument being made. Half of people in the church were saying that Jesus was exactly how we call it today. Triune, one with the Father, of one being, one substance. That's actually where we get this language from. They pin it down here, or at least really begin to. And the other side, the other half of the church was going, no, Jesus was the first created being. And it was led by, I believe, a man named Arius. And of course, you could see that's quite the difference. Is Jesus a created being, or is he divine, fully one with God? That's what's being argued at the Council of Nicaea. Not the Bible, not who's in charge, this theological question. And a lot of bishops were chosen as representatives of their faith communities because at that time they may have contact with multiple churches. That's what bishops do. And so who better to go and be a voice for the people who can't travel hundreds of miles just leaving everything to go talk about Jesus? So the story goes, the main proponent of Jesus as a created being stands up and begins to sing a hymn, about how great Jesus is and how he is the first created being. And St. Nicholas is there, and he does not like what that guy is saying. He believes it's blasphemy and heretical, and so he stands up and he slaps the man singing and is kicked out of the council for that very reason. Now, there's no record of that actually happening. We have, to my knowledge, some records of what they talked about, who was there. Nicholas isn't one of them, nor is that event. But it's a really good story. And let's be honest, no one expected to have an image of Santa slapping a heretic. So maybe the song should be updated. You better watch out. You better not pout. You better not cry. You better not have bad theology. I'm telling you why Santa Claus can come to town and lay hands on you. Again, it's one of those weird, awkward, funny, interesting stories that we have. And it's not one that we typically tell our children on Christmas Eve. But here it is, part of our church tradition as well. Again, images of Santa, right? Red clothes are actually probably from his bishop garb. Red has traditionally been colors that bishops wear, especially on big holy days. But that has all kind of been changed. You would probably picture somebody maybe a little bit darker of a skin, beard, probably a darker beard, red bishop wearing cloak, maybe a bishop's staff, right? And now, today, we don't picture Santa that way. We picture Santa in this big wintry coat that's red with sashes and a white beard and, you know, definitely white and rosy cheeks and overweight, which probably looks like the farthest thing from Saint Nicholas. Does that ruin Christmas? I don't know. If I'm being honest, this is one of the things we struggle with in our own home as our kids, you know, see Santa, believe in Santa. But at the same time, the Santa that they've begun to know, they also recognize isn't quite who Saint Nicholas is. So it's one of those interesting parenting moments that when they asked, is Santa real? I said, well, kind of, right? I don't know about you. I don't know how everybody else got to navigate this interesting dilemma. But that's how we did it. We're still basing it off of good old Saint Nick and his life and his mission and ministry and serving Christ. So that's kind of how we try to keep also Christ and Christmas in my own home. I wonder, how did you all navigate that? How do you all envision Santa Claus? How were you taught and raised with Santa Claus? All those good questions, right? What are the things we've shaped this season to be? Finally, we'll leave with this. And this will tie back to the first one, gift giving. Not all cultures give gifts on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day. For a lot of us, throughout history, the gifts come in connection with the Magi, the three wise men who come and give three gifts to the newborn king. But that doesn't happen until Epiphany. Many of us have combined these stories, and to be honest, they don't come until much later. The story says that it could be up to 2 years later. Instead of seeing a newborn baby Jesus wrapped in clothes and swaddling clothes, he may be a toddler walking around. But there are still plenty of traditions out there, even going on currently today, where you give the gifts is on the Three Wise Men Day, on the Magi Day, where gifts were actually given. So it's not a tradition that fully stems in all cultures with Santa, but with the Magi. Okay, on to the Bible. Now, I will say, we did not finish our entire Bible study of what we have, going through all the aspects. And I think we're going to plan another Zach Ruins Christmas next year, where we continue. But for right now, we have gone through an Advent study that has been wonderful, going through almost Matthew's Gospel, the perspective from Joseph's point of view, you could say. And so we got to hear a lot of interesting ways in which maybe that narrative of how we understand Joseph and the Holy Family has changed, what has influenced us, right? So what's interesting about Joseph is he has no speaking role in the gospel. We are told that Mary and him were engaged, but in that day that was viewed as almost already a married contract, as if everything was for sure drawn up near finalization at that time. And if it ended, if that contract was broken through, you know, sleeping with somebody else, it certainly would have communicated Mary cheated on Joseph. So if Joseph backed out, it would have said she cheated. However, if they stay together and she's pregnant, it would have shown Joseph couldn't keep his hands to himself. And this is big. We got to remember, in that day, in that time, the culture was a shame, honor society. So this would have impacted Joseph's family. It would have impacted Joseph's life, his choices, how Mary and Joseph were perceived going forward. We have to keep that all in mind. These are stories that yes, they're stories, but if we hold them in the proper context of the culture, They have meaning. They have weight. One of the more famous aspects of the gospel narrative of Jesus' birth is the three wise guys. In Matthew, scholars hold that they're probably Persian, some maybe practicing Zoroastrianism, which is a religion that's still practiced today. They were concerned with the stars, and they had competing deities of good and evil, right? We would assume that this is a practice, that these three wise guys were somebody who were practicing their faith, that were higher up, that were wealthy, that were part of the religion, maybe even part of the court of those ruling in the foreign country, such as Persia. Because who has the time, the money, and the lifestyle to notice the stars and then travel the distance from a long, faraway country? If we kind of calculated it out from kind of Persian Empire kind of area to Jerusalem, it could take up to 90 days. Assuming all went well and it's just a straight walk, it could last probably up to 4 months, depending on travel and weather and all of that. And you guarantee it's not just three guys showing up, although that's how it's often depicted in movies and shows and how we depict it in our own nativity scenes. But honestly, it's probably a whole gaggle of people showing up with servants and slaves and tents and supplies that you could travel for 4 months with, right? And make that long journey on top of the gifts they were going to give. Which also makes sense if they were somebody who was important, could be given as delegates by a foreign, you don't want to say government because probably everything at that point is ruled by Rome, but these faraway people are probably delegates coming to celebrate the king. That's why they show up in Jerusalem. Because where would a delegate who in their own religion show something important of a new ruler showing up? They would go to the city of the capital, where the temple and the palace are. They would be looking for the king there. And that's why it's interesting that then we see that Herod's like, news to me. I didn't have no kid, right? And we know this guy, Herod, is not a nice guy. He is somebody who's killed his own family because they may have threatened his right and rule as somebody who has power in this area. So it's not too far out of line to think that he's conniving enough to go, yeah, let's find out where this new king should be born, and then you come back and you tell me, you confirm it for me. And of course they do. We find that the scriptures point to Bethlehem, and so Herod's scribes point the people in that direction, the three wise guys in their group there, and off they go. And lo and behold, they find the Messiah there. Now, as I've said, we think that this could have happened anywhere from a couple of months after Jesus was born to all the way up to 2 years. And why do we say that? Because after the wise men give the gifts that are for a king, right, they get warnings by an angel to go a different way. Don't return to Herod. And in this, Herod decides to kill everybody under the age of 2. So why we say it's probably 2 and under, that there is a likelihood that, you know, 16-month-old Jesus is up there walking around with Mary running after him and Joseph trying to keep him out of his tools and, you know, all that fun stuff that we have as parents and we know as parents with toddlers. This is when the wise guys could have shown up. At the same time, we're told that the Holy Family is told to leave because of Herod's response to the wise men not coming back. Another good question is, how long did that take? Was it a month? Was it a week? Was it a year? We don't know. The Bible doesn't give us that kind of a detail. But what we know is that before the age of 2, or at the age of 2, Jesus and the Holy Family, Mary and Joseph, probably left Israel as refugees, right? They would be the definition of refugees, running because of political aggression and violence. Their ruler is seeking to kill any political opponent that could rival his authority and power. And that would be the Messiah, baby Jesus. So another fun thing that I have heard that scholars often say is that if they were to go somewhere, where would they have gone in Egypt? Can we be any more specific? And some would say Alexandria. Alexandria, Egypt would be a place where the Holy Family may have settled, either for the whole time there or part of it. Think about how people come to our own countries, immigrants, whether they're fleeing as refugees or coming in totally legally as immigrants. We settle in areas, we form around communities, right? You think of Chinatown, Little Italy, Yuki Town, right, for us. We have these pockets of our own population, and we know actually there was a strong population, a large population of Jewish people living in Alexandria, to the point where we actually have the Hebrew Bible, the scriptures, being translated into Greek there, so the story goes, in Alexandria. So it's not too far-fetched that that would be a place where the Holy Family would settle down for their time in Egypt. Okay. But here's the wrench in that. We have no historical facts to back that claim up. Matthew's story, we have nothing in anywhere that tells us that Herod commanded that every two-year-old and under be killed. Matter of fact, it sounds suspiciously like Moses and his story. And we're going to be honest, Matthew wants us to see Jesus as, yes, the Messiah, but also as the new Moses, the one greater than Moses, because there was one greater than Moses promised to God's people in the Old Testament. And so there's a little bit of a parallel here. So can we say it's fact in the way that we today want to say things are factual? No. Can we say it lines up real nice and pretty with everything we know? Maybe not. But we have this story. This story that communicates a family who is young, who is just trying to make it in the world, who's trying to raise a family, be a family, who go through hardship, who get blessed and are a blessing apparently to the world, even if it doesn't feel it. I think for us today, there's more being communicated that we don't have to hold everything nicely and neatly and make everything function as one cohesive story. Because I'll be honest, the Gospels and those who deem these Gospels as truth and as valuable for our salvation did not find it reasonable to smooth out the bumps and maybe some of the disconnects. There was a guy named Marcion who tried to do that, make it so that way there was one gospel and one story and everything flowed together, and he drew heavily from Paul, and we didn't need the Old Testament because we're in the New Testament time now and we don't need four gospels, we just need one. But as a church, as the people of God, we've held up these four testimonies, these four witnesses, these four beautiful gospels, and have said, even if they don't all agree on every single minute detail, that's okay. We're okay with that. And maybe that can speak to our own wantings and needs when it comes to our own faith and our own faith journey. We also began talking about the birth narrative in Luke. First off, Luke seems to have two beginnings of his gospel story. Traditionally, if you were to have a story begin with a genealogy, it would look like Matthew. Matthew begins with a genealogy. This is the genealogy of the Messiah, Jesus, the son of David, right? And then he goes into the genealogy, ends that genealogy with, and this is the mother of Jesus, the Messiah, right? And then the next frame he picks up is, and this is how the Messiah came to be, or the birth of the Messiah came to be. There's emphasis on what's going on. But the biggest part is that you have the genealogy beginning that and the story moving forward. Luke, it begins with almost like a beforehand story of setting up the birth and the genealogy, where you have what happens before John was born, what happens before Jesus was born. And that's the first two chapters. And then we get the genealogy, and it kind of flows much like Mark from there on. So scholars actually believe that maybe the first two chapters were added. Whether that's by Luke or later, nobody can ever be for sure. But it seems like, at least for whatever Luke the author was doing, he must have found, thought of, added these secondhand. I don't think that adds or takes away to our faith. I think that just shows a little bit of insight into who Luke is and what was important to him. There's also allusions here in Luke's gospel that we hear in the birth narrative with Zechariah and Elizabeth, with Abraham and Sarah, the barrenness, the God doing new things. There's God's salvation at work pouring out of the first two chapters in Luke. And we can see that the story kind of follows more of a Mary perspective, right? We are told 6 months into Elizabeth's pregnancy, an angel, specifically Gabriel, goes to Nazareth, where Mary is, and tells her the good news that she will be the mother of the Messiah. Again, this is taken in the understanding that she is somebody who is being asked to participate with God, and she accepts. This is not forced upon her, but something that she agrees to. But here's some backstory. And we talked a little bit about this in our Advent study, that there is a book called The Proto-Evangelism of James, or The Proto-Gospel of James. And it depicts an older Joseph marrying a younger Mary. Mary, they give a whole backstory as being the daughter of unknown people because she's living at the temple and the people are taking care of her there, and they cast lots to see which old widowing priest will take care of Mary so that way she stays a perpetual virgin. And so we get a lot of backstory of who Mary is and her theology. That's where we get depictions of an older Joseph and a younger Mary. But to be honest, that was written many, many years later, like easily over 100 years later than the rest of what we would consider the New Testament. Most scholars would say contextually, culturally, Joseph was probably somewhere between the age of 16 and 18. Mary was probably 12 to 14. You could say that they were brought together as matchmakers. If Joseph lived in Bethlehem, she lived in Nazareth, commonplace might be Elizabeth. Bethlehem was close by. He was part of the Davidic line. Maybe there was some connection there. And it wasn't uncommon to have a matchmaker for marriage between people. And so that's how the Holy Family could have come together. Some things that are a little in tension here is where are they from? Jesus dies as being known as Jesus of Nazareth. But what the Gospels are saying, but he was born in Bethlehem. Luke kind of alludes that Joseph is living, if not at least from Bethlehem, but there's not real clear understanding if he's living in Bethlehem or living in Nazareth. That timing and that language isn't clear. What would be common during the day, and even what Jesus mentions in some of his parables, is you have families living together. The son would usually move his bride back in with him and his family. You may have them build an addition onto the house, a room onto the house, or they may build a house next to them, but usually it's the son remaining with his family and bringing the wife in to that family circle. And so that kind of ruins this idea. If you go back and you reread, there's no person who's an innkeeper. The language that now many translate it as is guest room. That we could say that maybe there was no room in the guest room that the family would have, because hospitality dictates in ancient Near Eastern culture, which Judea and Israel was and still is, just not ancient. Hospitality, you wouldn't let strangers sit in park benches, or especially family, not be welcomed into a home. But maybe there was enough traffic that the guest room wasn't available, or even yet, Joseph wasn't done with his room or his part of the house for him and Mary to officially move into. That was kind of one of the last things you did as a married couple. That's how you knew you were married. You would officially start living together. So maybe it was Joseph went, grabbed Mary from Nazareth where she was, still staying with her family, and then was hoping to move them in, but it wasn't quite ready yet. Now, what we did talk about, that when Mary and Joseph arrived to the family home, it was most likely not just them not having a place to stay, so that idea of the inn and the innkeeper is gone. Part of the proto-evangelism of James suggests that they were in a cave. That's why you actually have some depictions of the Holy Family in the narrative as in a cave, which could possibly be true. Underneath a house, they may have built on a cave or put it a little bit underground for the animals. But the first century home may have looked like a courtyard or a downstairs where you might be able to bring in the animals on the first floor, any animals that you might have. That would include also a space for cooking. And then your second floor would be a place where the family would rest and eat and sleep. Maybe the guest room was there. I highly encourage you to look up first century homes in Israel, Palestine, Judea, and just kind of get a good picture of these, because they're there and it's wonderful to see. And it gives us an idea of where Mary and Joseph most likely were, where and how Jesus was most likely raised. But also, it lets us know that it would have been even more of a shame and a thing for the family if Joseph's parents, if that's who he was staying with, didn't help them in. If instead they let him go out elsewhere, it would have been great shame on the family for that. You mean you're pregnant, your grandson, your firstborn grandson is going to be had out there. You're not going to have the midwife. You're not going to have the family around you. It would have been a big to-do, right? The family would have had shame. And so most likely, Mary had Jesus surrounded by family, surrounded by the women, surrounded by the midwives. She was not alone. She was not outside in a stable somewhere, but part of the home, surrounded by family. And we know this because even the word that we often have translated, mistranslated as an inn, which is more of a guest room, that Greek word, we already know both inside use in the Bible and outside of the Bible, that word isn't used for an inn. There is another word for that in the Greek language, and it's not that. So it's most likely there was no room in the guest spot or this extra room that Joseph was making, and that wasn't ready. So where did they go? They were given a spot, yeah, by the animals, but at least they weren't out of the house, somewhere else, in the wilderness, cast out. And I think that's important to one, so that way we redeem a little bit of Jesus's family, Joseph's family, right? Who has for centuries now gotten a bad rap, if we're being honest, about like not welcoming their child and grandchildren into their home. But also that reminds us that Jesus and Mary and Joseph were surrounded by family and celebrating with family the birth of Jesus. and we still do that today, many of us gather around, that tradition still holds true. So maybe there's a little bit of a breaking and ruining of Christmas that it's not in the stable, that maybe our nativity scenes don't look that accurate, that maybe we could reframe it, right? With instead of that's the stable, that's the home, because some of them do look like homes. But we have to recognize that for many of us, our nativity scenes have just Mary and Joseph and baby Jesus. That's probably not the case. There were probably tons of other women that the Bible just doesn't tell us about because they don't find it to be crucial details. And that's pretty common in how things were written in that time period with those people in that context. It would be called Jewish meditative literature. And they don't always give you every detail, especially the details that we may want, but they do give you the details that are important. So we have to keep that in mind as we're retelling these stories, as we're reading our Bibles. Something else we thought of as we were reading these stories. Is just, again, some of the details of Quirinius was governor, and we know when he was governor of Syria. And to be honest, at this point, none of that really makes sense. From what we know of history, we can find that person in history during the reign of Augustus, and that's, he probably wouldn't have had that reign, that power. As I said, there's some just language that doesn't add up. Where is Joseph? Is Joseph in Nazareth? Is he in Bethlehem? Where is he? And we don't really get too many good details on that. And that's frustrating. There's no clear line, even in the Greek, that says Joseph was from Bethlehem, and he went to pick up Mary, who was in Nazareth, and then they stayed in Bethlehem. But if we do some finagling, if we're being honest and loose, we can say, well, Matthew does say that the Magi find them in Bethlehem, and that means that they didn't come right away, right? We know that there was some time in between when Jesus was born and the Magi came. So maybe they did set up shop in Bethlehem and this is where they were going to live, which is why more scholars would lean that Joseph is from Bethlehem, living in Bethlehem, and not from Nazareth and living in Nazareth. But the issue becomes, at the end of the story, and at least in Luke, it says, and they both went back and lived in Nazareth. Or it alludes to they were both from there and went back there and stayed there. Ooh, that makes things a little hard. Again, not always do our scriptures tie everything up in a nice little knot and give it to us. And even then, sometimes culture and context and history doesn't help us all that much either. But I'd like to say that what it does give us is some insight and some background, some imagination to get closer to Jesus. I was talking to somebody recently when I said, you know, it may not always be helpful, all these little other details that we're asking, that we're seeking in the story, that we're trying to fill in with context and culture, but I figure it's the same way in which you date somebody. When you're dating somebody, especially for those of us who are married and we think back to how we met and fell in love with our special person, there's a lot of things that you find out not just from them, but from their family and their people, right? I tell the story of learning that my wife loved sweet potatoes so much as a child that her nose and cheeks were red or orange. That doesn't necessarily add anything life-altering to my relationship with my wife, but it fills it out, doesn't it? Gives us just a little bit more. So I hope that's a little bit of what we get, what we see here, that our time together as we were in this Bible study, and I'm sure there was more that we talked about that I haven't covered. I know we talked about why it's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and why those Gospels. But again, that's the joy of being in the Bible study and rather than listening to it online. And so with that, I will say this. I hope this time together leaves you with more questions than answers, that it invites you to want to learn more, read more, be in your Bible more, start talking to Jesus more, asking him questions and prayers and your thoughts. I hope that this helps you recognize that maybe not all the time our faith needs to have every answer of everything for every question we have. And that maybe this side of the kingdom of God, this side of heaven, we have some mysteries, and that's okay. Some of us need to learn that lesson of mystery is okay sometimes. And also, I hope that this didn't terribly ruin Christmas for you. I highly doubt anybody is walking away going, and Christmas is ruined, and I hate Christmas. But I do hope that it shattered maybe some of the preconceived images we hold in our head about Christmas. Maybe it shatters some things that we assume or take for granted in the story. And maybe it just allows us new pathways forward to explore this part of our faith, this season of our faith, in big and beautiful ways. So, my friends, my family, I pray God's blessing on you. I pray that you get to enjoy and explore your faith as much as you can in every way that you can, because that's part of what we're here to do. That, again, Bible studies and all that stuff, that's just here for us to really explore, learn, grow in our faith. And may I pray this prayer that we've been praying after after every sermon. This is our Advent prayer, and I pray that you take this with you this season. Merciful God, always with us, always coming, we confess that we do not know how to prepare for your Advent. We've forgotten how to hope in miracles. We have ignored the promises of your kingdom. We get distracted by all the busyness of this season. Forgive us, God. Grant us the simple wonder of the shepherds, the intelligent courage of the Magi, the patient faith of Mary and Joseph, that we may journey with them to Bethlehem and find the good news of a child born for us. Now, in the quiet of our hearts, we ask you to make us ready for his coming. Amen.